So one of the things that I want to talk about tonight is the institution of a takana, or gezerah. So there are, the Rambam lists five types of Torah Sheba'al Peh. He breaks Torah Sheba'al Peh into five different groups, categories. There's received traditions, either received traditions that a particular Kal V'chomer may have been handed to Moshe at Har Sinai, or just a Halacha L'Moshe Mi Sinai, something that was given to Moshe as a tradition, whether or not it's anchored in the text. The second level of Torah Sheba'al Peh, the first level is things that are anchored in the text. The second level is things that are not necessarily anchored in the text but are still part of Torah Sheba'al Peh that have been transmitted from the beginning, what we call Halacha L'Moshe Mi Sinai. The third is the things that we derive through hermeneutic principles, right? The things that we derive from the Yud Gimel Midot, the things that we derive from our interpretation of the Torah, or our interpretation of the interpretation of the Torah, or our interpretation of the interpretation of the interpretation of the Torah. Because that's where we are today. We're interpreting Rishonim, or Achronim are interpreting Rishonim, who are interpreting Amoraim, who are interpreting Tanaim, who are interpreting Chumash. But that's all part of the third, that third group. Right? That third group is the most dynamic because that's where you really have a something that, on one hand, it's the product of human intellect, it's the product of human thought, but on the other hand, it has the status of a deoraita. Right? So, for example, we'll give an example from life that we're all familiar with. We're all married, so we all got married by means of Kiddushei Kesef. Right? The chassan puts a ring on the finger of the kala and says the Hareat Mekudeshet Li line, and that's what binds them as a married couple. Now, obviously, the Torah never talks about Kiddushei Kesef. The Torah doesn't talk about rings. It may talk about rings in other contexts or as gifts, but not as a means of getting married, right? In Devarim, you have ki yikach ish isha uva'ala, right? A man takes a woman and lives with her, sleeps with her. Kiddushei Kesef is derived from a gezeirah shava. That when it says ki yikach ish isha, there's another pasuk in Bereishit, which we read last week, which talks about Hasadeh Asher Lakach Avraham. Avraham bought a field from Ephron. So the same way that Kicha in that context refers to, he bought the field.
Right.
He bought it for burial. So it's Kicha, Kicha. We make this analogy between the Kicha over here, which talks about payment of money, and the Kicha over there can also mean payment of money. Now, when, even though this is something which is derived midrabanan, it's derived by, it's something that the rabbis came up with through their interpretation of the Torah. And nevertheless, it has a binding status on the level of midoraita. So when, that's a complicated,
I couldn't look at two words and say, okay, Gezeirah Shavah, and we're sold to make a lot of it.
Right. So it depends. There are different levels, different layers of Gezeirah Shavah. There are different types of Gezeirah Shavah. There are earlier ones and later ones. And a Gezeirah Shavah, essentially, originally it meant an analogy. That we assume that words have a consistency of meaning across multiple texts. So if this word has a particular connotation here, then it can have the same connotation there. It doesn't necessarily mean that it's a, meaning there's a logic to it. And then there are other Xeris Shavas, generally later Xeris Shavas, that are, there's not necessarily any logic to it. It's almost just like a hypertext link.
Those are later ones primarily?
Like those are later ones primarily, like later in the Gemara.
No, but I mean, did you give an example?
Off the top of my head, no. Off the top of my head, a Gzera Shava. A Gzera Shava is where there's the same word or the same root appears in two different places, and that sort of creates a bridge between those two texts. Right? So this is, it's like any. You know, it's a modern word, but it's an old concept. Like any intertextual link, like any words that link two texts, how much meaning there is to that intertextuality is subject to interpretation. Sometimes it makes more sense, and sometimes it doesn't. So the Rabbi Yishmael, who listed these things, who listed the 13 midot, he listed it as a way of interpreting the Torah. And it wasn't necessarily, in his time, it wasn't necessarily formal. I'm trying to remember, I believe it was Professor Shaul Lieberman who wrote a history of the Gzera Shava, right? How the Gzera Shava is used in the earlier sources and how it's used in later sources. In the earlier sources, there is much more of an obvious internal logic, right? That the two texts that you're linking have other things to do with. It makes sense why you would want to extrapolate from one to the other.
I mean, an example, you know, there are plenty of Gemaras where it says, well, if I don't need it to teach me this, then it's an extra word. If I don't need it to teach me this, we'll teach that. You know.
Right. So there, it's not necessarily.
It's much more
of a formal. Right, that's what I'm saying. That's the later type of Gzera Shava. It's a much more formal.
It's almost like an accounting.
Yeah, right. This word, like every word, has to teach something.
Yes.
You're not looking at context. You're not looking at what the general sense of this pasuk is. Right. Here, in the case of kicha kicha, of stay Ephron, it says ki yikach ish isha, when a man takes a woman. And is it fair to say that when you talk about taking, is talking about like he clubs her over the head and drags her back to his cave? No. Just like we have in other places that lakachat, and even, you know, today we talk about mekachu memkar, right, buying and selling. Right? Mekach is more of it connotes a cash transfer. How do we know that? Because elsewhere it connotes a cash transfer. There's an internal logic to it, right? It's analogous statements.
Well, it's a business transaction.
It's transactional.
So.
Yeah. Right, well, that's what Kiddushei Kesef is somehow. It is, it's on some level, it's a cash transaction. It's not a purchase.
Is there such a thing as
it's a financial arrangement.
Is there a shava in any other
Gzera
place or
Kesef and Shava Kesef?
In any law, and anything else outside, is this our unique
what?
Gzera Shava?
Yeah, so that's what Shaul Lieberman says, that it's that there are ways of thinking in Greek contexts, in Greek rhetoric, in Greek poetics. It developed organically within Judaism in different ways. Right? But that the original style of thinking, and this is similar to what Reb Tzadok was saying, that in terms of the intellectual development of Torah Shebaal Peh, they were using tools that were developed by the Greeks. We're just applying them to understanding the Torah. So, back to Kicha Kicha Mistei Ephron. We learn from this analogy, which was not given Halacha Moshe Misinai, and it was not given this Gezeirah Shava wasn't given at Sinai. It's something that's developed later by the rabbis, and the Rambam says as much explicitly. Nevertheless, it has the power, it has the authority of the Torah. because it's extrapolated from the Torah. So it has the authority of the Torah, which means that if somebody gets married with Kiddushei Kesef, even though this was something developed by Chazal, if they get married using Kiddushei Kesef, and then the woman commits adultery, she's a married woman who commits adultery, and she has, you know, the penalty according to the Torah would be death. It's not that she violated something. She violated the two people that violated, right? You have to violate. Adultery is something that you can't do alone. So the two violators of adultery are both in violation of the Torah commandment of Lo Tinaf. So that's that third level where on one hand you have human creativity, human invention, human interpretation, but it's creating rules that have the authority and have the power of the Torah itself.
Well, what's the practicalness, though? Like,
you mean nowadays?
What about it's just been a Derabbanan? Practically speaking, so here it's a Derabbanan gets authority, Deraita, like.
Okay.
Obviously, there's certain ramifications.
There are ramifications. It's not just, I mean, now that we don't have any sort of enforcement mechanism, there are still ramifications. Like, for example, for the status of a child. The status, meaning if this woman has a child with her paramour and not with her husband, what's the status of that child? Is that child a mamzer mida oraita or a mamzer mida rabbanan, and that's going to have ramifications.
Okay, the system of listening to the laws of the rabbis, and if you're going to observe rabbinic Judaism anyway, it's not a question.
No, there still is. It's you're right in terms of we're not enforcing anything anymore today anyway. We haven't enforced anything in a long time. So what's the point? The Raisa Derabanan.
You're either going to buy in or you're not going to buy in. It's not this, okay, we're going to say, oh, because it's a Gezeir Shava and that has this.
No, but internally,
okay,
internally.
If I have, okay with it. If that wasn't the case, I would have done it. They would have created.
No, it's not a question of buy in or not buy in.
If you're a Derabanan without a Gezeir Shava, you would have done it anyway.
It's not a Derabanan.
I know, but I'm saying the fact that it's better than a Derabanan, more powerful than Derabanan, on the level of Derabanan, we don't need that. Maybe at one point, maybe they needed that to solve the system.
No, I still think it's meaningful today. I'll give you an example. The clear example is that we have a general principle, Safek Deoraita L'Chumra, Safek Derabanan L'Kula. So if it's there's
going to be practical ramifications,
right? So there's a rhetorical difference. No, but is there an essential difference?
If there's a suggestion that the deoraitaness of the Yugimli Karim or the
Yugimli Midos,
Yugimli
Midos, Shatorah Nidreshet Bahem, yeah. All these 13s, like who knows 13? I know 13. I don't know 13. Do you know 13?
But if intonation that the deraita nature of the hermeneutical principles is because they're trying to do something here and they need that kind of authority, like for us who are already bought into that, it might come out as having practical differences, but it's not, as game-changing as perhaps it was in its time when the rabbis were using these principles and crafting a lot of
that rabbis. Could be. That could be.
Especially
it could be that
later uses of Gezeir Shavah and stuff where it does seem more like a
it could tool. Be that for us, yeah. What you're saying, it sounds like, is that for us, Doraita Derabanan, what that does is it creates a certain hierarchy of values, it creates a certain hierarchy of severity that we might relate to a Doraita and a Derabanan differently, that violating a Doraita we would consider to be much more problematic than violating a Durabanan, but we're aware that on all of these things, we're relying on the interpretation of the rabbis. So even though there might be practical differences, and even though we might relate to them differently, ultimately we've bought into the fact... Right, we've ultimately bought into the fact that it's different level of norms. Right. Ultimately, we've bought into the fact that this is the system, this is what is, and we might relate to one thing more severely and one thing less severely, but really it's all part of, it's all rabbinic interpretation. Is that what you're...
It's all rabbinic interpretation, and the interpretation, but it could have also been based on the halakha Moshe Sinai, but we bought into the system, it's not, we bought into system A, and now they're trying to change it to system B, and are we going to, how comfortable are we with that? We're past that point, and bought into the system as a whole, to use these principles as to how, practically speaking, halakha is going to apply in a certain case, fine, but it's not as earth-shattering as, you know, what was happening when
I don't know. Were you here last week? I gave a shiur between Mincha and Maariv.
No.
Okay, I gave a shiur on... What?
The umbrella shiur.
The umbrella shiur. Talk about the umbrella. There's a dispute between... Noda Yehuda and Chatam Sofer, the Noda Yehuda says, I'm choshish that it's a doraita, that this is a malacha doraita. Chatam Sofer is like, maybe it's a derabanan, but it's probably not even a derabanan. Chatam Sofer presumably didn't carry an umbrella. Chatam Sofer even says that it's not mishnat chasidim, it's not the greatest thing to carry an umbrella on Shabbat. But they're relating to it in different ways. The Noda Yehuda was getting up, and it's pulpit in Prague, in the Alt-Nishul, if you've been there, and railing against those who carry umbrellas on Shabbat, whereas Chatam Sofer is like, Ein lahar ish et ha'olam, don't make such a big deal of it. So maybe they are being overrun at their Abanan. Don't make yourself nuts. Right? So there are all kinds of, you're right, if you need to like drill down into the details, suffik, doraitas, how we relate to it, meaning is the rabbi going to get up and go crazy about people violating a Durabanan? Probably not. Violating a Doraita? Much better chance. Okay.
Let's get started.
Okay. We're going to talk tonight about the period of the Zugot, the pairs. So, in the Mishnah in Avot, the first half of the first chapter of Masechet Avot is all chronological, starting with, you know, later on it gets all, even the entire first chapter, later on it gets all mixed up and different people from different ages, from different time periods are mixed in with each other. But from the beginning, right, you start starting from Moshe, the first Mishnah takes us up to Shimon HaTzadik, and then you have Antigonos Ish Socho, and you have Yosef Ben Yoezer and Yosef Ben Yochanan, and so you have, each generation had a pair of, had two sages. Now this is, we're talking about approximately the years 200s until about the Common Era. Right, it's hard to know for certain. But if Shimon HaTzadik, well, we had that Gemara that we talked about last week where Shimon HaTzadik meets Alexander. If Shimon HaTzadik meets Alexander in the 330s, like I said then in Josephus, it's not Shimon HaTzadik, it's someone else. But either way, if Shimon HaTzadik is around the time of Alexander, his student is Antigonos, and you already see in the name Antigonos, what kind of name is Antigonos for a nice Jewish boy? It's a Greek name. I don't know if you saw, there was the word Yerushalayim, spelled like we spell it today with two yuds, was just discovered in a dig in Yerushalayim around Yer Binyanei HaOma, and it talked about, it spelled Yerushalayim, and it was a graffiti, and it had the guy's name, and it was like Hananya ben Dodlos or something. Right? I was thinking Dodlos is Daedalus. Right? The guy who invented the labyrinth. the father of Icarus, guy who flew Icarus. So
it's Ariadne's daughter.
That I don't remember. I know Ariadne was able to escape the labyrinth.
Well, Theseus got her out.
Right, so this is something else.
The wall of strength.
Right. Daedalus was the designer of the labyrinth, and he and his son flew out of it because they made wings, and Icarus flew
too close to
the sun. It melted the wax, and he crashed to his death. Fine. But you had somebody living in Jerusalem named Daedalus, which is kind of cool, but they had Greek names, and you have it all over the Mishnah. Tarfon. Avtalion.
This period, I mean, it was a tremendous amount of Hityavnut.
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 Yes, there is. And
I don't recall that much in terms of the Tanayim addressing it. I mean, Matityahu and his family addressed it.
Okay, Matityahu and his family, there you're talking about in the 200s before the Common Era. Right. So if we want to go through the general history.
The Persian period.
This is what Julie's been waiting to hear. Okay.
And I don't have a pen.
It's all right. It'll be on. It's being recorded.
Take notes on your phone.
I don't know how to do that.
Okay. The succession.
Go back a little further.
Okay. Let's go back to Bayit Rishon. Okay. There was a succession of dominant empires. Okay, the Assyrian Empire is dominant in around the 700s before the Common Era, the 8th century before the Common Era. They, amongst other things, conquered the 10 tribes, the Aseret HaShvatim, exiled them, never to be seen again, and they also laid waste to most of Yehuda. That was the miraculous story of Chizkiyahu, that the Assyrian army woke up and behold, they were all dead. The Pasuk literally says they woke up dead, so that's why Yerushalayim was spared. That's in the 700s.
700
BCE. A few generations later, you have the Chaldean Empire, right? Babel, the Neo-Babylonian Empire. Kasdim in Tanakh, they rise up, they take over for the Assyrians, they take over from the Assyrians, but the Assyrians, Sefer Yonah is set in, Nineveh was the Assyrian capital, right? So Sefer Yonah, that's the Assyrian Empire. The Chaldean Empire, so some of our good old friends like Nebuchadnezzar and Nebuzaradan, they're Kasdim. Sancheriv, Evel Merodach, those are Assyrians. Assyrians and Chaldeans were both from the Fertile Crescent, were both from what's today Iraq. Chaldeans were from closer to the mouths of the river, right? Closer to the Persian Gulf. And meaning Babylonia was their capital. Babylon was their capital.
The Chaldeans.
And Assyria, Ashur, that's more northern Iraq, like where Tikrit is today.
Mosul
is right near Nineveh, yeah. Right?
So once they woke up dead, they left Jerusalem to the Jews?
Yeah. And Jerusalem, that's why the Yehuda, right, the Malchut Yehuda survived for another 100 years after another 130 years or so.
They didn't wake up dead, by the way.
No.
The Tanakh actually says they woke up dead, which is it's kind of amusing. I guess not if you're Assyrian, but if you're reading Tanakh, right? Okay, so the Assyrians exiled 10 tribes. I think the year that they give is 722 before the Common Era. Judea becomes a tribute to the Chaldean Empire in approximately 597. That's when Daniel and Hananiah and Mishael and Azariah all go into exile. That's the first wave of exile, 597. 586, after Tzidkiyahu, the king of Yehuda, rebels again, they come in and destroy the Beit HaMikdash. That's when Nebuchadnezzar destroys the Beit HaMikdash, 586 before the Common Era. Okay?
And that's Babel, Chaldeans,
Chaldeans is Babel. Kastim, Bavlim, Neo-Babylonians, Chaldeans, all the same thing. Okay? They were the world power in those times. Okay? A couple more generations, and his grandson, Belshazzar, is celebrating the fact that he's celebrating in his path, in his castle, and all of a sudden there's a hand that appears, starts writing on the wall. Daniel comes, interprets it, says, "Your time is up." And that night, the Babylonian Empire was overthrown by a large empire to its east called the Persian or Median Empire, right? These are Iranian tribes that had gotten together, had united, and at some points it was the Medians who were dominant, sometimes it was the Persians, but they're listed together, Persian and Median, and you even see that in Megillat Esther, where we have Parasu Madai, right? The Persians and the Medians. Their capital is Shushan, or Susa. They become the world's dominant empire, and that was the largest empire. The Persian Empire was the largest empire that the world had ever seen until that point. They take over in the 530s before the Common Era, if I'm not mistaken. Might be a few years off. The 530s before the Common Empire, before the Common Era, and it's a massive bureaucratic empire, which sort of sets the stage for Ezra. Now, in rabbinic chronology, the Persian period lasts only 52 years. Rabbinic chronology doesn't even work with Tanakh. Right? If you look in Tanakh, the Persian period is much longer, and in the annals of other, of world chronology, it's also much longer. There's about 165-year discrepancy. But if you look in rabbinic writing, they'll try to paper it over. They'll say, yes, Nebuchadnezzar destroyed the first Beit HaMikdash in 586 BCE. It was rebuilt 70 years later in 516 before the Common Era, and then the second Beit HaMikdash was destroyed in 70 CE, having stood for 420 years. And they're like, wait a second. No, I'm not that bad at math. Something's wrong here.
When they started it versus when they finished it.
So there's all kinds of differences. So this problem of the missing 165 years is cleverly called by some people the Persian Gulf. And Lemaisa, we know that the Persian Empire lasted a lot longer than that. It lasted from the 530s until around 350. It lasted for about 200 years. It didn't last for 52 years. Right? And that's where the discrepancy is. The Chazal tried to microwave it by saying that, Xerxes and Cyrus, Artaxerxes and Cyrus and Darius, they're all the same person. When really, there's more than one Darius, there's more than one Artaxerxes, there's more than one Cyrus. Right? This dynasty, the Persian dynasty, is called the Achaemenid dynasty. Ahasuerus is one of them. Ahasuerus is the Ahasuerus that we all know and love from the Purim story. Is Xerxes, right? So if you read about Xerxes and the Battle of Thermopylae and all that stuff, Xerxes is Ahasuerus. Ahasuerus is Xerxes. It's the same name, right? The way that it's pronounced in the way that it's written.
It's like Ian and John.
Well, it's even more than that. Xerxes is the Greek form of the name, and the Persian form of the name is like Shayarsha or something like that. So a lot of times when you start a word with like a hsh in Hebrew, you would add an aleph just so it could be pronounced. So it's like Achsh, right? So you get Achshverosh, right? So it's the same name. It's the same name. And he reigned in the 400s before the Common Era. Okay. After him, you have Artaxerxes, he's the Persian king who sends Ezra and Nehemiah on their respective missions to fortify that backwater province at the edge of the empire near the Egyptian border called Judea. Okay, moving on. Persian Empire sticks around till the mid, late 4th century before the Common Era, right? 300s. And it was then, it was weakened for a long time. It had lost several wars, starting in the time of Xerxes. It had lost several wars against the Greeks. But it was a massive empire, and the Greeks weren't so strong, so it continued to function. In the 300s, before the Common Era, you had this first Greek consolidated under the rule of Philip of Macedon.
We know 586 BC, the first Byzantine was destroyed, 70 yeah. CE, the second. But when was the second Byzantine built?
So 516 is when the Mizbeah started to operate again. When it was actually rebuilt. It seems that it was rebuilt in some form already just 70 years later, which is what Yirmiyahu's Nevuah was.
Which was...
516. What kind of structure it was, Jerusalem hadn't been fortified, and Ezra, the Sefer Ezra Nehemiah describes how when people saw it, the old-timers were crying, because it's like, this is you call this the Beis HaMikdash. And the you know the younger generation, they were jubilant, but the older generation was weeping.
Until Herod came.
Well, it was rebuilt several times. One of them was Nehemiah came, and he built the walls of Yerushalayim so that you could actually have a defensible city. Yerushalayim's prestige grew gradually throughout these hundreds of years. Okay. So that takes us to about the mid-300s. Philip of Macedon consolidates Greece. His son, Alexander, who had not only inherited the throne, but had also been tutored by the greatest Greek minds. His tutor was Aristotle.
Ezra
Nehemiah is in 440s, 450s before the Common Era. Alexander is 100 years later.
Oh, 516...
Who's on the ground? Zechariah, Haggai.
Yeah, you see, that's again another thing.
Ah, okay.
No Navi, I don't know where the Navi okay. are besides, you know, sure.
The last ones are Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi, right? Malachi, we don't know who he is. There was no person named Malachi, and even in the Sefer Malachi, it doesn't. His name isn't Malachi. It means my messenger, my agent. Haggai and Zechariah were the Nevi'im who were there, boots on the ground, during the rebuilding of the Beit HaMikdash. The leader, the political leader, was Zerubbabel, who was a grandson of, you know, he was a descendant of the Davidic line, right? And on Hanukkah, we're going to sing Kates Bavel Zerubbabel. The end of the Babylonian exile was Zerubbabel. He was the one, the first one to come back to Eretz Yehuda with a smallish group of people. And you had Yehoshua the Kohen Gadol, who you'll also see in the Haftorah on Hanukkah, that he's the Kohen Gadol at the time of the rebuilding of the second Beit HaMikdash. So those are the key leaders, Haggai, Zechariah, Yehoshua, and Zerubbabel.
And from them goes what, Ezra and Nehemiah?
Ezra and Nehemiah are a couple generations later. Andrei Knesset HaGedola. The Knesset HaGedolah takes place in the times of Ezra and Nehemiah. Now, it's not clear, is the Knesset HaGedolah a one-time thing, or is the Knesset HaGedolah some sort of informal body that continues to meet throughout the next century? Either way, Shimon HaTzadik is towards the end of that. So either Shimon HaTzadik is really, 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 really old at the time of Alexander, or he wasn't necessarily that old, but you just had... It was a multi-generational thing. Okay? Alexander, he died young, right? He got an early start and he had an early end. He conquered He just took over the Persian Empire. He conquered the entire Persian Empire. He conquered Egypt. He conquered Eretz Israel. And then he was on his way to India. Like he went further than anybody else. He just kept going. You have cities named Alexandria today in Afghanistan and in Uzbekistan. It's phenomenal. Like the greatest conqueror possibly in world history.
Genghis Khan.
Yeah, that would be the other. That's the other candidate. And.
Big Khan.
And he died at the age of 33. About. His empire was divided between four generals. One of them was actually named Antigonus, right? Like the Tana that we're reading about, Antigonus Ishsofo. One of them was named Ptolemy. He took Egypt. And one of them was named Seleucus. And he was the king in Syria and Iraq. Eretz Israel is right in between the Seleucids and the Ptolemies, right? What became the territory of Seleucus and the territory of Ptolemy, and it was contested between those two empires. At first, Eretz Israel was part of the Ptolemaic Empire, and after several generations, in the 200s before the Common Era, the Seleucids conquered it from the Ptolemies, and that's when the Hanukkah story took place. The Greek enemies during the Hanukkah story are the Seleucids, the Syrian Greeks, not the Egyptian Greeks.
Seleucid.
Okay, whatever you want. Seleucid, Seleucid. They're the enemy during the Hanukkah story. The Ptolemies, with the Ptolemaic interaction with the Jewish people is the famous interaction is the translation of the Torah into Greek. That happened under Ptolemy II, Philadelphus. Should I keep going until we have a minion? Or? Okay. Then I think we should. I think we should stop here. So today ended up being a little bit of general background, and then we'll pick it up. So there's another week that I don't have to prepare. That's excellent. So next week we'll do the zoo goats.